Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hey, welcome to Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. I'm Jason.
I'm Kevin.
I'm John.
And I'm Scott.
And we have a great show for you today. Let us know what's on the OR schedule for the day.
Well, Jason, today we have Dr. James Fleshman. He's here to give us an in-depth author's perspective on the newly published article in the JAMA titled Effective Laparoscopic Assisted Resection versus Open Resection, Stage 2 or 3 Rectal Cancer and Pathologic Outcomes. But first, a random fact of the day. Hey, Jason, you know who Frederick Ernst Kruckenberg is?
Well, that's the Kruckenberg tumor guy, right? The malignancy to the ovary that metastasized from, you know, the GI tract. I'm assuming he's probably a surgical oncologist or gynecologist back in the day.
You would think that, but he's actually an ophthalmologist from Germany. And when he was 25 for his thesis...
Wait, did you say you said ophthalmologist?
Yep, like the eye doctor. And for his thesis in medical school, their version of medical school, he actually studied the GI tract and how it metastasized, and he described the fibrosarcoma ovarii multicellular. And so that is what he's known for, and he's not known for anything in ophthalmology. I'm not even sure this has ever metastasized to the eye before.
Sounds like he found his true calling. And that has been your random fact of the day.
So welcome, everybody, to another episode of Behind the Knife. We're going to jump right in and very pleased to have Dr. James Walter Fleshman, who is the chairman of the Department of Surgery and Surgeon-in-Chief. He's also the Seeger Endowed Professor of Surgery at Baylor University Medical Center, Dallas. Dr. Fleshman, thank you so much for joining us on Behind the Knife.
Scott, it's my pleasure. Thanks for asking me to do this.
So I obviously know you very well, but for those listeners out there who don't, can you give us a little bit of background where you grew up, where you trained, and how came to the point where you came to Dallas?
Well, I'm originally from New Orleans and grew up partway in New Orleans and partway in Shreveport, Louisiana. Moved out of Louisiana in when I was 13, went to Northern Ireland and went to an all-boys public school, which is a preparatory school there, and decided I wanted to be a physician. And my dad moved us back to St. Louis when I was 18, and I went to Washington University, pre-med, and then medical school, and then residency. And then I took 2 years in the middle of that residency to do research with Gordon Philpott on CEA, and decided to join Bob Fry and Ira Codner, who were both mentors of mine during my residency, and ended up doing my fellowship in Toronto with Zane Cohen and Robin McLeod, Hartley Stern, and went back to Washington University and joined Bob and Ira as one of the first academic colorectal surgery programs in the country. All three of us were full-time on professor track and grew from there. My original focus was to run the anal physiology lab and to do research on muscle control and determine whether or not we could chemically enhance the pelvic floor muscles to prevent some of the incontinence and to correct some of the non-relaxing puborectalis stuff that we were seeing at the time. And that moved on to laparoscopy. I'd gone with them to learn how to do pouches in Toronto when I was still in the lab, and we started our experience with ulcerative colitis. Ira had been treating patients with rectal cancer with radiation for many years and had a reputation for that. And so I was looking for something that was new and decided I would take the challenge that Nat Soper through my direction. He said that he thought that I would eventually be doing laparoscopic colectomies in 1991, and I just laughed at him. Then I went back, and we got into the lab, and we started writing about it, and controversies over port site implants from colon cancer operations through the laparoscope became a question that I tried to answer in our lab, and we were successful to find out it was absolutely a mechanical, technical issue. And Dan Jones, who is the professor at Harvard at BI Deaconess, was part of that effort. And we grew the department as we went along, and Bob Fry eventually went to Philadelphia to Thomas Jefferson and then the University of Pennsylvania, and Tom Reed came and joined us for a while. Ira and I were joined by Elisa Birnbaum, and Tom moved to Pittsburgh and then to Lahey Clinic, and then Dave Dietz came from Cleveland Clinic and spent some time and then went back, and Matt Much and Steve Hunt came through our residency program and joined the faculty, and about, I guess, 10 years ago, I moved part of my practice to a smaller hospital, not downtown, but still affiliated with Barnes Hospital in Washington University, and I became the chief of surgery at that hospital, and it sort of whetted my appetite for more administrative efforts because I found out I could change the quality of medicine and help people do a better job by helping them with processes, and it was fun to make decisions that influenced outcomes for patients at a broader level, not just in colorectal surgery. And then I'd been grooming Matt Much to become the chief of colorectal surgery, and I felt like it was probably time for me to kind of step out of the way, and I got an offer to move to Dallas to be closer to my two daughters who live here already, who have jobs, and my wife told me I was going to take the job, so we're in Dallas.
So one of the things that you do have a lot of is experience across the broad range of not only colorectal surgery, but general surgery, being a board of directors on the American Board of Surgery, you know, a member of obviously the Gastrointestinal Surgery Advisory Group for the Board of Surgery, a past president of ASCARS, and governor for the American College of Surgeons, amongst many other things. How do you keep it all straight? You know, a lot of people out there want to get involved. They want to be active. They want to rise up the ranks. But we all recognize that at the end of the day, it's hard work and time management. But do you have any thoughts in terms of being a colorectal surgeon, sticking with the American Board, and staying in general surgery?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. Having been in the first really academic colorectal surgery group, we realized that it was our responsibility to make colorectal surgery stand up to its part of surgery as a whole. Before then, you know, there were bright lights. Abkarian was a chief of surgery at U of I and had an endowed professorship. There was, and I'll probably forget somebody, but Randy Bailey was doing strong work. There were people in academic institutions around the country, but they weren't fully integrated into the academic program. And we felt like it was our turn to make colorectal surgery a true power within the house of surgery. And Bob Beert was having trouble keeping up with some of the stuff that he was doing while he was on the board. So that went to Bob Fry. Ira had already been on the board of surgery. And then when it came my turn, Bob Fry turned to me and said, "You got to do this, and you got to do it because you have to protect as well as enhance the house of colorectal surgery within the house of surgery." And that's an awesome responsibility when someone tells you that. And you can go about it in many different ways. You can be an antagonist or you can be a collaborator. And I've always been a collaborator, and I've always felt like I value my general surgery training, and I value the fact that I am first a surgeon and second a colorectal surgeon by heritage, and that every colorectal surgeon in the country should be proud that they are indeed general surgeons. How can we make us even prouder? And that is to take a prominent role in research, a prominent role in administrative leadership, a prominent role in political leadership in the Board of Surgery. And, you know, the things that I was allowed to do in the Board of Surgery were different than Bob had been allowed to do. We were restricted to never being the committee chairman on any committee in the American Board of Surgery. While I was there, I worked hard enough that I got to be a committee chairman. I'm hoping that that leads eventually to a colorectal surgeon being able to be the chairman of the Board of Surgery. That's still not part of it. So those little things that happen when you're doing something are key to the success that you have on any of your efforts. How do I handle that? You know, you focus on something, you do your absolutely dead level best. You don't take credit for anything that's not due you, and you don't emphasize that you've done anything and let someone else take credit if they want to take credit for it. But you know that you're working hard to get things to happen. When you're trying to balance, that's difficult. And my family made some sacrifices, a lot of sacrifices, for me to do what I've done. But they're proud of them, too, because I remind them that they allowed me to do it, and I was representing them wherever I was. So I think that's key. Otherwise, I would have felt guilty all my life that I hadn't been home for every baseball game and every softball game and every concert. And I miss those things. I still have a relationship with every one of my kids, and I love them dearly, and I think they respect what I've done over the years. So you have to make choices, and I've relied very heavily on my relationship with the Lord. He's opened doors for me that I never anticipated walking through, and he's helped me get to the other end in every circumstance that I can think of. So that's how I've done it.
Dr. Fleshman, you briefly mentioned Ireland, and I know you grew up there. Can you talk about that time and then, you know, eventually returning back to the States?
I was in Northern Ireland in a little place called Bangor County Down, which was a seaside resort. The school I went to had 600 boys in it. It was 12 years old to 19-year-old academic oriented program, still had the old houses within the school. We lived 14 miles outside of Belfast. The year we got there, there were some rumblings of some conflicts between the Catholics and the Protestants. And let's be frank, this wasn't about religion. This was about haves and have not, and money and poverty. And I think that has been clearly established now that Southern Ireland has as much economic strength as Northern Ireland. And the problems escalated to 1972 when we finally left. They were blowing things up on the main street of Bangor County Down. So we decided not only did the oil drilling enterprise that my father was supporting fail, we decided it was time to get out of Dodge. And I had thought I might actually go to medical school at Queen's University in Belfast, but decided that that wasn't going to work with the troubles that were going on. So I dearly loved my time in Northern Ireland. I learned to play rugby, cricket, ran track, played golf on links courses all over the north of Ireland, and had a real a great time and made some really true friends that I'm sort of sorry I haven't been able to keep up the relationships with over the years, but know that they're all doing well.
So now it's time for our dissection of the day, and having Dr. Fleshman here, we're going to delve into a little bit of a particular topic, and that's the ACOSOG Z6051 randomized controlled clinical trial, which is the effect of laparoscopic assisted resection versus open resection of stage 2 or 3 rectal cancer on pathological outcomes. And of course, Dr. Fleshman is the lead author on this. So before we delve into that, I do want to ask you a little bit about what were the early days of laparoscopic colectomy like? What were the difficulties, and did you ever think it would come to the point where you're leading a trial such as this?
I really didn't. I knew that we had some steep learning curve to get over. There was no standardization of technique. People were doing stuff, then you would, some of it you would look at and go, oh my God, what are they doing? And others were being very meticulous and trying to follow a pattern. We thought we had to do everything just like we did it open, and that was the mistake. What we learned eventually and didn't learn right up front was that if you can do things a little differently, you can actually do it better, and you're learning new anatomy based on a video view rather than a up-down view from above as an open case. When I first started doing laparoscopic colectomy, I took a ton of heat. My partners would stand in the room and laugh and say, why don't you just get over with it and open? And others would laugh at me because I was trying to direct multiple people to do multiple things that they were not naturally trained and skilled to do. It's like run the camera or use an assistant grasper, and so there was a lot of times in the operating room that I'm not particularly proud of, so to speak. And as we got further and further into this, we started realizing that there was a pattern that we needed to follow: high ligation of vessels of initially, development of embryologic planes that led you to the mobilization of the whole segment of the bowel that you were looking at. Retraction with gravity, how to fix the patient on the table. They kept falling off at first, and then we figured that the beanbag worked better. Instruments that didn't have the right tips that were damaging tissue, finally got those to be non-crushing and non-cutting, and realized that we could do the operation that we said we were going to do. And we sort of measured our success by the number of instrument exchanges we did at the beginning. We would put instruments in and out and in and out, and so our trocars would fall out. We'd have problems with that. Now we put one instrument in to grasp, one instrument in to use energy, and never do an instrument exchange. I mean, that's how different things are now. When I went to the ASCRS and Bill Scirocco and those guys started talking about port side implants, I sort of panicked and went, oh gosh, we've been hurting these patients. And I wanted to show that the laparoscopic portion of the carbon dioxide pneumoperitoneum was not the source of these. So we spent about 5 years doing studies on hamsters with a human colon cancer line called GW39, where we showed that it was the pneumoperitoneum that blew the tissue around, but it had to be crushed or broken into first for it to happen, which meant that we were violating cancer principles during that first short period of time. And standing in the back of the room at the ASCRS in 1994, Bob Beard, Heidi Nelson, and I agreed that we had to come up with a trial that proved this was safe for patients. Rick Billingham was on his stump for eliminating laparoscopy because he felt like it was unsafe. And Heidi and I sat down and we started writing, and she wrote the majority of this protocol for the COST trial, and we all got together. We kept our heads down and decided that we'd put the science to it. Once that was through in 2000, I said, well, we got all the data in on the colon. Let's start for rectum. And I brought the trial to the ACOSOG GI committee 7 years in a row before it was finally accepted. And I'd written the protocol myself initially, and then I got Anne-Marie Bowler to help with it. And she was Heidi's fellow at the time at Mayo Clinic. And we worked back and forth until we had a presentable copy. And it changed so many more times between then. I can't remember how many revisions. That eventually made it through the NCI GI committee. And then we were rolling. We got $3 million from the CTEP fund from the NCI. And Duke was our home base for the ACOSOG, which eventually moved back to Mayo when Alliance came on, took over ACOSOG. But the idea was that the group of people who had been enthusiastic about doing the COST trial for colon were still around and wanted to be part of the rectal cancer trial. And we had tons of meetings at ASCRS and American College of Surgeons about how to establish the trial, what it should look like, what is a laparoscopic case, what's an open case. The arguments were fierce, but always ended up with a handshake and a beer afterwards because we really worked together. And then in 2008, when we started the trial, we knew we had to accrue quickly, and we needed to hit at least 10 patients per month. And as the trial went on, people became really comfortable with laparoscopic surgery in the pelvis, and so they stopped enrolling patients to randomize. And I had to call in some debts and some favors on people. And, you know, someone like Maher Abbas and Virgilio George, who were the top accruers, I leaned on them really hard. You got to put these patients in this trial so we can get the answer out of this. We got to put the trial, got to put the patients in. So I'd make phone calls every week and get people to enroll somebody, and we'd go up a little and then down a lot. And then when we finally got all 486 patients enrolled, it was like, oh my gosh, now what am I going to do with my time? Because I got nothing pounding on me. And I fully expected this trial to come out saying, yeah, there's nothing wrong with laparoscopy, and it's a non-inferior technique, and it's something that wasn't going to be earth-shattering. So when I got the result, I was pretty darn surprised. And I think that's why it ended up being published in JAMA, was because it wasn't what people really expected.
So let's go into it a little bit. Can you tell the audience, for those who are unaware, a little bit about the results of the trial? And more specifically, why did you set it up as a non-inferiority trial?
So statistics rule the world. And when you're trying to show a new technique is able to accomplish what you hope it will accomplish in terms of cancer outcomes or short-term outcomes, you have to design the trial so it's a meaningful result. And the non-inferiority process allows you to do that in a much smaller sample size than you would if you were trying to prove equivalence. Equivalence would have required 5,000 patients in each arm, or 5,000 patients total with 2,500 in each arm, and we would have never gotten it done. So what we've done in the past, and the COST trial was the first one to use the non-inferiority process, is look at a predicted outcome for the open group or the control group, and then establish a level of difference that is clinically relevant, that if the test group falls below, it would insinuate that it was inferior, and if it's above that level, it's non-inferior. So it, you can go ahead and assume that it's almost equivalent. And the only way to determine equivalence is to then do a meta-analysis of multiple trials from multiple institutions around the world that have been designed in a same, in the same format, looking at the same outcome and the same end result. Hence, the reason I gave the protocol to Jaewon Oh in Korea, who did the Korea trial, and to Andy Stevenson in Australia, who then did the a la carte trial, because we know now that we can actually take the results, put them in a meta-analysis, and come out with an answer that says one way or another of equivalence. The non-inferiority status of a technique really is, you know, you have to think about it backwards with a double negative. So it's not non-inferior now because it had a problem. We chose a composite outcome for this trial because looking at circumferential radial margins really doesn't answer the question of the technique, because the biology of the tumor can sometimes make the circumferential radial margin positive. The completeness of the TME is a true surgical outcome. Combining that with circumferential radial margin and distal margin gave us the best measure of a surgical technique and accounted for the biological behavior of the tumor. And we knew that there would probably be somewhere around 90% circumferential radial margin negativity. We anticipated that we would have about a 90% TME complete or near complete and complete rate. And we hoped that our distal margins would always be negative, because that is definitely a surgeon-derived metric. Putting together a composite, we said that there would the clinically relevant difference between an open operation and a laparoscopic operation should be 6% of the successful procedure. The successful procedure being a complete TME with negative circumferential radial margins and negative distal margins. We picked 6% because if you look at every medical oncology paper in the last 3 decades, 6% has been their relevant difference. And we figured in surgery, we ought to be able to achieve a 6% difference. And so the non-inferiority state said that if the laparoscopic technique provides less than 84% success, when we're predicting that the open would provide 90% success, then it's an inferior product. That's how we did it.
Dr. Fleshman, you mentioned that you were, you know, surprised with the results of the study. Do you feel like this was an issue, how you defined open versus laparoscopic, or, you know, what specific outcome were you surprised about?
Well, now that I've thought about it a while, I'm not surprised anymore. We think that the laparoscopic technique really does a great job in the abdomen. When you get down to operating in an upside-down Coke bottle, it's a little more difficult. And so the instruments are coming from a lateral angle. They're trying to reach into a deep pelvis. You don't have control of the camera. Your visualization is impaired because you're trying to look over tissue that keeps falling into your way. And so now I say in the low pelvis, which I'm predicting that's where the fallout is, laparoscopy probably doesn't function as well as an open operation. The open operation can rely on a hand in the abdomen to get down to the base and stay in the same plane, feel the tumor, get outside it, and try to make it complete. So our definition of laparoscopy and open is critical to this. laparoscopy was considered to be a laparoscopic, total laparoscopic, laparoscopic-assisted, or hand-assisted laparoscopic, as long as the pelvic dissection was done under pneumoperitoneum using instrumentation in the pelvis and not the hand. Open technique was described as any open operation or any hybrid operation where the upper abdomen was treated with laparoscopy and then the pelvic dissection was done through an open incision using open instrumentation in a normal way. That allowed us to really get to the answer because had we said that hybrid was a laparoscopic approach, we would have mixed the laparoscopic area with open operation.
So I'd like to go back to your outcomes a little bit. So one of the things that you mentioned was your overall thoughts were that the open resection was going to have a successful outcome in about 90%. If I remember right, your successful resection for open was about 87%. And I know the confidence intervals were a little bit more than that. But in general, both of those were a little bit lower than what you suspected. Does this aspect of the open resection have any influence on the ultimate conclusions of your study?
Well, it could if you focused on one area, and that is to compare the circumferential resection margins between the two. There's a little higher circumferential resection margin positivity in the laparoscopic group than in the open group, and there's also a slightly lower complete TME rate in the laparoscopic group. Our Data Safety Management Board, the DSMB, that is the safety quality group, looked at the overall results of the study. And in the paper, you'll notice that that's the first paragraph of the results, that we actually achieved what we predicted we would achieve, that there would be at least 90% across the board success of individuals, and then the composite rate would actually be the successful rate. And the 87% success is an acceptable statistical difference from the 90% that we were looking for, as long as the other end of the comparison was low. So the composite score was 86.9 in the open group and 81.7 in the laparoscopic group. It was still almost 6% down. So that's why the confidence intervals went below and stayed outside on the laparoscopic group. Statistically speaking, that automatically puts us in the not inferior because we were close enough to the 6% difference and the bottom limit went down so that the two confidence intervals didn't cross down at that level.
Now, your overall conversion rate in this study was about 11%. Did this shock you? And kind of along those same lines, your complete pathologic response in the two different cohorts was 22%. What are your thoughts on each of those?
So the response rate is what it is. These are randomized these are randomized after completion of neoadjuvant therapy. Everyone in the study was eligible for laparoscopic treatment. No one got put into the open arm because they couldn't have undergone laparoscopy. These were all considered potential laparoscopic patients. A conversion rate of 11% is much better than the conversion rate during the original COST trial, which was 20%, and actually started out at 29% and in the second half went down to 19%. So we're well below the learning curve on conversion in this. And so these were expert surgeons who had been validated as laparoscopic colectomists in either part of the COST trial or with video and op notes. And then everybody was was credentialed based on their ability to do a TME laparoscopically, and we assumed that if you knew the plane to do it laparoscopically, you could do it open. So the randomization process worked, in my opinion. The bias of selection for the good cases going in the laparoscopic group and the bad cases going in the open group doesn't fly because the randomization was made after the neoadjuvant radiation. And I'm pretty sure that the complete response rate, wouldn't have made a difference either way. So and if you look at the clinical T stage, they were identical. There was a slight increase in patients with low rectal cancer in the laparoscopic group, which may have influenced some of the problems with TME, and that's one of the things that I accept. But that's only a 3% difference or 4% difference. We tried to remove as much bias on this as we possibly could as we got started and let randomization do its thing.
Sir, can you comment on the a la carte trial and how their findings are similar to yours?
Well, they used the exact same protocol we did, except they liberalized the definition of the rectum up to 15 centimeters. They also allowed all stages of rectal cancer into the trial, so not as many of theirs got the neoadjuvant stuff, which is the same way of looking at it as Jaap Bonjer's trial with color 2. They liberalized the rectal definition, and they put a lot of people in that had stage 1 lesions as well as, up high lesions. And the a la carte trial was designed the same way ours was designed in order to really get to the core matter. Are curable advanced, locally advanced tumors amenable to a laparoscopic approach? That's really all you really want to know, because upper lesions you can do. You're not going to be working in this little bony box. They don't really need adjuvant therapy. So by, handcuffing ourselves to stage 2 and 3 cancers that all got radiation and chemotherapy, all below 12 centimeters, we pretty much told ourselves, here's your biggest challenge, go for it, see what you can do.
So you had mentioned a little bit earlier that Jaap Bonjer in the Color 2 trial was published earlier this year in the New England Journal of Medicine, and their final statement in there said that long-term outcomes of Color 2 trial indicate that laparoscopic surgery is as safe and effective as open surgery in patients with rectal cancers without invasion of adjacent tissues. Can you comment a little bit about that, and why are these, for people out there that are not as familiar with that, why are the two conclusions different between yours and the a la carte and in this particular trial?
So they were looking at a long-term survival. We will eventually get to long-term survival in local recurrence. And we may, and I hope, will find that there is no difference in survival and local recurrence based on these two groups in the randomization process. Jaap Bonjer's trial, when you look at the circumferential radial margin or circumferential resection margin positivity in the open group in the low tumors, the positivity is 22%, as opposed to the laparoscopic group where it's 9%. If you do the math and take out and give them the same circumferential resection margin positivity, and then you compare everything again, the laparoscopic does poorer than the open. So that 22% actually is what screws up their results, in my opinion.
You mentioned that these studies are done by experts. How does this apply to the average colorectal surgeon or the general surgeon out there going to tackle rectal cancer?
Well, getting a 90% composite success rate is a pretty tough task, and we set our goal high because we wanted it to be a study that could stand up to criticism. I don't know that an untrained, low-volume surgeon is going to be able to do what these guys did. These are people who focus on this. They've been trained this. We had an educational session before we started the trial. We had all been to all the teaching courses that we could all be in, and most of them were teachers themselves. And we educated our pathologists on what the circumferential resection margin meant and how to get it. We used people who were focused and in institutions where they were being held to high standards and quality controlled on a daily basis. I don't know that every community surgeon can say that they are doing that. And if they value their patients' lives, I think that they should probably hesitate to be doing low rectal cancers with a laparoscopic approach at this point. Not that their skill is inadequate for doing it, it's that if something happens and they do end up with circumferential radial margin that's positive and local recurrence, they'd better be able to document that their technique is at least as good as the people who did the study that showed that the technique is inferior to open.
So point blank, at least for the short term until we settle this, is laparoscopy for rectal cancer dead? Are we committing against standard of care if we're doing laparoscopic surgery for rectal cancer outside of a study?
point blank, yes. I think that people who are conscientious and trying to do the best for their patients that aren't in a data collecting situation will want to at least stick with an open approach because they know how to do it. The same thing goes for a different approach. If you're using robotics and there's no data that says it's equivalent or better or worse at this point, I think you should be collecting your data and being able to audit it and publish it. And the patients need to be aware that this is a new approach or something that's a little different, and we're still trying to find out whether it's appropriate or not, and they should be able to help make the decision on which approach you use. I think that laparoscopy is not dead. I think that there are probably patients with stage 1 and 2 cancers that are in the mid-rectum and upper rectum that are fully treatable with adequate results. And laparoscopy is certainly going to be cheaper than robotics to take care of those patients. And they get the minimally invasive approach benefits from doing that. I personally have been keeping all of our data on a multidisciplinary team database. I think the new American College of Surgeons Rectal Cancer Program in conjunction with the Commission on Cancer will provide an opportunity for anyone who wants to participate and continue to do laparoscopic or robotic treatment of rectal cancer because their data will be collected and it will be audited. But if you're in an institution that doesn't have that availability, I think you're hanging out there in the breeze. And that's the same thing we told people with colon cancer. And you know what? The American surgeon supported that. You saw the bump in use of laparoscopic colectomy for colon cancer after the trial said that it was acceptable. I would anticipate that you will see a very low level of adoption of laparoscopic treatment of rectal cancer going forward until we get the answer for this.
Okay, now it's time for our tips and tricks segment. We're going to stick with the rectal cancer theme. Again, this is where our experts help us with some helpful hints to get us out of those sticky situations. But so what we're going to talk to you a little bit about is stepping away from the trials for a second. One thing that comes up with rectal cancer, probably more than anything else, is the subtle differences, even beyond laparoscopic versus open. Can you comment a little bit about your thoughts of teaching or approaching the various factors, such as how do you handle a small tumor that may be anterior in a man and just right up against that plane of the de Nonvieux fascia versus a posterior tumor in a woman? And there's so many things that go into rectal cancer that these trials are so difficult to be able to take a look at. Can we investigate these differences? It would take a lot of patients, but you know, both in a trial aspect as well as just clinically approaching them. What are your thoughts on this?
So, you know, Jerry Marks and John, his son, have stuck with the Tata methodology for many years, and in a low rectal cancer placed anteriorly in a male, the up-down approach is probably inappropriate. The down-up probably is appropriate, and I think you can maintain that plane better from below in the prone jackknife position with the buttocks taped apart and a deep retractor or a Tamis-type procedure where you have exposure is probably the way of the future in that area. I mean, that's a terribly difficult dissection to stay out of the seminal vesicles and out of the prostate and yet maintain the tumor border. A female in a wide pelvis in a posterior position, while I think that's fairly straightforward, and you can get a really good margin. You can see all the way down to the pelvic floor, and you can get all your instrumentation down there, and you're not struggling. And they may not need a TA TME. They may just need a low anterior resection, and whatever way you do it will probably work. So we don't have the data that says who failed and why they failed yet from any of the trials. We need to break all those down. And I think that'll be a really interesting subset analysis by meta-analysis to figure those ones out. So the tips that I have for those is if all you can do is a laparoscopic or an open approach for those patients, is that de Nonvieux fascia is your friend. And if you'll stay behind it and you can see, great. If it's down so deep in the pelvis that you can't see, then that's where you need to decide how are you going to fix that. And, you know, a lighted retractor, a good tilt, complete relaxation, a person pushing the perineum up towards the abdominal cavity while you're dissecting gives you all the advantage that you can get to make that happen, and you can still get in the wrong place. So that's why I think TA TME may actually have a role in those anterior male low rectal cancers.
Sir, a second question I have for you is regard of whether to perform an APR versus LAR in terms of pre and post neoadjuvant chemotherapy. For example, if you have a cancer in the levators prior to chemotherapy and you're thinking APR, but then after chemo radiation, you see that you get a huge response. Will you then change to an LAR to save the sphincters?
Well, that's a hard question. And there is no right answer. We don't have enough data. But if the tumor has retracted from the invasion into the sphincter mechanism and the levator muscles, and it's mobile now, I think we might all agree that we would probably try to do a sphincter-sparing procedure. On the other hand, if the tumor has poor response, but and there's still a considerable amount of tissue within the lumen, but it's released on the outside from the muscle, I think I would probably err on the side of doing a wider excision and taking the levators and doing an APR. You really have to know how your tumor responds. So a complete response, total response, and a prior invasion into levator based on MRI, I think, wow, that's a stretch to make me do an APR, as opposed to still a lot of tumor left in the lumen and the tumor regression grade is not a good grade, then I think you still need to do the aggressive surgery.
Final question for the tips and tricks. Out of Europe, Torberg Holm and some of the other ones initially published the extra levator APR, the ELAPE procedure. Obviously, we don't want a positive circumferential margin and we want to avoid a true waste. But then a lot of subsequent data, including meta-analysis data, came out and showed that the ELAPE versus quote-unquote traditional or conventional APR was really no different. Do you have any thoughts on this extra levator approach, the cylindrical approach versus a conventional standard APR that would potentially follow all of the traditional oncological principles that would avoid a positive margin, but would still doesn't have to be all the way out?
So Phil Quirk should be acknowledged and congratulated on changing surgery for rectal cancer. He and Bill Heald single-handedly or four-handedly taught all of the European surgeons how to do this operation. And then I was fortunate to have him visit Dallas when I first got here to help train our pathologists how to do the bread loafing and look at the circumferential radial margins and really compare the specimen to the MRI that Gina Brown has brought to us for rectal cancer specific protocols. The discussion that Phil and I had during that visit was, can you selectively take out one side or the other as opposed to doing a blind cylindrical big operation and leaving no pelvic floor behind? And I have to say, he pretty much felt like if you're taking out a good margin on the side that the tumor's sitting, it's probably reasonable not to do the entire pelvic floor. Makes it a lot easier to reconstruct, and it also takes away some of the morbidity of a non-healing perineal wound and the need for huge flaps. So an extended extra levator approach is appropriate when you've got the tumor involving the entire pelvic floor. I have to say that's pretty darn rare. As well as, it's probably not going to be circumferential in all cases, and so I think you ought to do it as selective as possible. But when you look at the specimens that Phil is using to make his recommendations on, they were totally incomplete, I mean, major league incomplete TME with dissection right along the posterior muscular wall of the rectum, leaving almost all the mesenteric fat. And then you had that coned in gooseneck, or was it an hourglass shape? And you couldn't tell whether it was the hourglass shape that really caused the problem or whether it was the lack of TME that caused the problem. If your tumor is in the pelvic floor, take it out. Take the pelvic floor out. If your tumor is in the external sphincters and not into the pelvic floor, I don't think you have to go really wide on the pelvic floor to make sure you got it all. And the local recurrence rates, at least in our institution at Wash U when I was still there, were 4%. And I think that you can get lower recurrence rates just by doing chemoradiation combined surgery and not have to do the huge rectal resection.
All right, Dr. Fleshman, thank you for those tips and tricks. This takes us into our next segment, the final five. This is the part of our podcast where we ask you five questions to get the listeners to know you a little better. The first question we have for you is that when you're in the operating room, what is on your iPod or what music do you play?
Whatever's on the radio, and it's turned down real low.
What about if you're in the car?
If I'm in the car, I usually drive my car without the radio on, and my wife always has the Christian radio station on in hers, so I can't mess with that.
You'll have to start listening to Behind the Knife, sir.
I'll do that.
Number two, do you have any hobbies, talents, or interests outside of the operating room?
Well, I have four major talents. One is called Marin, the other is Liv, the third is Whitney, and the fourth is Jamie. I take full credit for my grandchildren, and they are so much fun. I like to play golf. I'm not very good at it, but it's my therapy. 4 hours outside, not thinking of anything but trying to hit a white ball exactly correctly is enough to take your mind off of surgery. And I like to listen to music, and I like to listen to people who can make music, and that's my talent because I certainly can't make music.
Question number three, is there a favorite trip or vacation that you have taken recently?
Last year in July, on our 38th birthday, not 38th anniversary, my wife and I and my two daughters went to Switzerland, Austria, and Germany for 2.5 weeks, and that was a trip of a lifetime. We were on Lake Geneva, went to outside of Lucerne and went up to the glacier, and then over to Austria and to Vienna, and then to the Bavarian Alps where the Ludwig castles are, and we had a blast. It was just, we did everything you could possibly do in those 2.5 weeks and rode the trains and saw scenery that was spectacular. In the middle of July, we were throwing snowballs on the Jungfrau Jagd glacier. That was a great trip. And my wife had it set up so that she even had the trains already, the tickets bought, the whole bit, because the German and the Swiss and the Austrian train systems are so incredible.
Number four, not only surgery, but if you were not doing medicine at all, what would you be doing right now?
I think I would probably be running a hospital, because the administrative side of the job that I have now has shown me that there is so much that you can do as a non-surgeon, a non-physician, to help other people. And that was my major motivation for going into surgery and medicine in the first place. So I think I'd probably either be stuck here in a hospital doing administrative work, or I'd be a missionary someplace.
All right, question number five. If you could go back in time and see yourself on the first day of internship, what advice would you give yourself?
Oh, my gosh. Well, first of all, get a clean white coat. Don't start in the emergency room on your first day. And make friends with as many nurses and staff as you possibly can, because they can save your life and your patient's life at any moment.
Well, that's very good advice. And Dr. Fleshman, we can't thank you enough. Congratulations on your publication at JAMA, and more importantly, completion of a very important trial looking at this laparoscopic versus open. And we appreciate the behind-the-scenes look at this trial and some of the things that went into it. And we really appreciate, and I'll speak for all the listeners, you taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us on Behind the Knife and telling us a little bit about yourself.
Well, thank you, Scott and John. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to your careers. I know they're going to be spectacular also, so enjoy.
Thank you, sir.
Just a reminder, we can be found at Twitter at Behind the Knife, on Facebook at Behind the Knife, and on our website at www.behindtheknife.org. We really want this to be an interactive experience, so give us your random fact of the day, your tips and tricks, or topics you want to hear. And we're also going to tweet out who we're interviewing that day, and you guys can send in your questions, and we'll read them live on the show. This podcast can be found on iTunes and any other podcast provider.
All right, looks like count's correct. Fash is closed and the dressings are on.
Until next time, thank you for joining us on Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Dominate the day.